Hello and welcome to this edition of Majlis. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. It has been exactly 20 years since Turkmenistan has adopted a neutral policy. Ashgabat seems very proud about it, as such that over the past 11 months, nearly 472 mass state-sponsored celebrations were organized to mark the Neutrality Day. The Turkmen president is also proud about it. Perhaps this is one of the few policies of the former president Niyazov, which owned by the current president Berdimuhamedov. But times are changing, so does the realities on the ground. The policy, which might perfectly sound wise in immediate post-Soviet environment, might not be useful anymore or even counterproductive. In this episode of Majlis, we will be looking into original idea behind Turkmenistan's neutrality and what did it turn to. To discuss the subject, I have Dr. Lukan Çiftçi, who is the author of Turkmenistan's Foreign Policy, Positive Neutrality, and the Consolidation of the Turkmen Regime. He is also director of Central Asian Studies Center at the University of Glasgow. Also, Ruslan Matiev is among us, who is head of the Turkmenistan Alternative News, a news portal based in Europe. As always, Bruce Panier is with us, who is editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you.
Dr. Luka, I want to start with you, but first let me play an audio segment from December 4th where President Berdimuhamedov speak in a gathering which was devoted on a Neutrality Day.
Şu hem borçnamaları ağlan ettim. Yani her bir birleşiklere ve hem birleşiklere katnışmalı.
With the declaration of our neutrality, we have committed ourselves to pursue the following main objectives: that we will not be a party to any military organization, we will not be a party and adhere decision made by the member states of such military organizations, not to start a war, not to take any step which could lead to a war, not pursue production of weapons of mass killing, not allow foreign military bases on our soil, and not to be a party to any step directed to put economic pressure on any country and recognize, respect the universal human and democratic rights and liberties of humankind and citizens.
Birleşik tarafından kabul edilen esasi demokratik hukuklarını ve adaletlerini ikrar etmek ve elbet olarak hormat.
Dr. Luka, here you go. This was President Berdimuhamedov, the value he gives to neutral policy and its outcome. First of all, please tell us, what is neutrality? What this concept is about and what does it stand for, Dr. Luka?
Well, it's something that no one knows. I mean, especially if you mean what neutrality means in the Turkmen context. The policy has been going on for 20 years. And, I mean, you played before Berdimuhamedov's declaration. If I didn't recognize the voice and just look at the text, it could have been just taken away straight from Niyazov's speeches, because right. He's saying exactly the same thing. In this sense, he portrayed neutrality more as equidistant, in the sense that he elaborated upon the military dimension of the neutrality, what Turkmenistan cannot allegedly do because it's got a neutral state. But neutrality is much more than that. It's also a policy of disengagement. It's a policy with which Turkmenistan has been able to stay at the margins of the international community for 20 years now. But it's also a policy of insulation, a policy that Turkmenistan has used to make sure that external pressures for liberalization, for human rights improvement, were never ever relevant into the domestic arena. So in that sense, it's a policy that can mean everything without really addressing nothing. So it seems to me it's a policy umbrella more than a policy per se. And this is especially visible when we realize that there is no such thing as economic neutrality. It's just about international relations. So it's a pretty vague concept, I'd say.
Right. Bruce, then, if it is something about nothing, how does it relate or related to needs or realities of Turkmenistan when it was adopted like 20 years ago?
I remember when Niyazov first started talking about this a little more than 20 years ago. His concept of neutrality at the time was rather limited, and he saw Turkmenistan as being a neutral venue, a neutral ground for two parties or two or more parties that were in conflict to come and meet and resolve their differences. Turkmenistan could provide the venue. They could act as a mediator for these kind of things. And that's how he pitched it. He said neutrality is all about three sides. And one of the examples was the inter-Tajik peace talks. The Tajik civil war was going on when Turkmenistan was granted its neutral status by the UN 20 years ago. And in fact, there were Tajik peace talks going on in Ashgabat when Turkmenistan actually received its when the UN made the announcement that it considered Turkmenistan to be a neutral country. This was ideally exactly what neutrality was supposed to be about. It had a very strong foreign policy emphasis that Turkmenistan was going to be the place that where peace was made regionally and further afield. You know, I would have to say that at the time it seemed to be working at first, because those Tajik peace talks, for various reasons, were postponed. But they did the round that was held in Ashgabat started on December 2nd, 1995, and didn't finish until July 1996. So, and then later we saw that there was Afghan peace talks a few years later that were held in Turkmenistan. And even the current Turkmen government, current Turkmen president, Berdimuhamedov, has pitched Ashgabat as a possible venue for Afghan talks, Taliban, the government. So this was really the concept of neutrality at first, was that Turkmenistan wouldn't get dragged into other people's battles or affairs, or conflicts, but they would provide a ground where these outside parties could come and resolve their conflict in the neutral territory of Turkmenistan. Now, obviously, as Lucas said, it's evolved into something far different than it was conceived.
Right. Obviously, we are going to talk about that subject in the second half of our discussion. Ruslan, I'm coming to you here. This neutrality, whatever it is, the way it is being portrayed in the country a lot. I was just talking about 472 mass state-sponsored events in the past 11 months devoted to neutrality in Turkmenistan. How this idea of neutrality is sold to people in the country, Ruslan?
Well, in general, the population is very proud of the fact that Turkmenistan is a neutral state. I don't know if the entire population fully realizes the concept behind it, the meaning behind it. That was very nicely put by Bruce. In fact, when we speak about neutrality, I think it's worth differentiating between the concept of neutrality and the Turkmen neutrality, because with the initial idea to have Turkmenistan as a peace land, you know, and as a platform for solving different conflicts, regional or global even, it turned into a shield for the government to close the country from the outside world. And actually, the concept of neutrality has been facelifted, so to say, and it expanded actually to the fact that no other state should involve into inter-Turkmen issues, that Turkmenistan has its own path. So this expanded version of neutrality is being promoted inside the country, and which is not right, which is not correct. Turkmenistan still is a member of the world. So, yeah.
Also, if you heard Berdimuhamedov's comment that I played a few minutes ago, part of that had to do with some internal issues, like in which he was saying that neutrality is also that the country respects the universal human rights of its citizens. But certainly it is something did not happen. What people understand from this neutrality, like, okay, this is one way that state tells them that this is the neutrality that, you know, outsiders are not going to involve. What it mean to people, for example, in their day-to-day life?
Well, I think there is no big influence. The fact that Turkmenistan is a neutral country does not make any difference into the everyday life. Maybe on the other hand, it's a slight burden, or not even a slight, but a burden for the ordinary people when they have to prepare for the celebrations. For instance, you well know that in preparations for the 20th anniversary of neutrality, the capital, Ashgabat, is seeing unprecedented actions when residents of other regions are forced back to their own regions until the celebrations end. So it's a burden for the majority of the population, especially those who are employed by the state, the civil servants, because they need to take part in demonstrations, in different mass events, like for example at the stadium or in concert halls, etc. And that means they will be taken out of jobs. There will be no free time for them, etc.
Bruce, you were mentioning what the idea was from the Niyazi's point of view, like that this country could turn into a place, a station where discussion could be held and all these things. Whatever the idea Niyazi had, why he could not succeed in implementing that?
I think he just didn't get enough outside interest, to tell you the truth. It seemed to work at first on a regional scale, that he was able to, because there was a conflict in Afghanistan, which was a neighbor, and because there was a conflict in Tajikistan, which was certainly not a direct neighbor, but a neighbor in Central Asia, he was able to offer up his country as a kind of a forum. I mean, I think that Niyazi's original idea was far broader, that he was hoping that, you know, conflicts that would happen in South America or Africa or something like that, he might also be able to get people from there to come and meet, you know, sit down at the table and discuss their problems too. But like I said, it never really seemed to take off except for Afghanistan and Tajikistan. And then as the years went on, Turkmenistan became more closed. And of course, it had its image problems started, so that all of a sudden it seemed a strange place to come and make peace, because everyone understood that the rights violations going on inside the country were phenomenal and on a huge scale. So it looked less attractive, you know. I mean, Niyazi was hoping it was something like, would be something like Switzerland, but it ended up being this. Well, we were talking, it's kind of like the Frankenstein monster. It was hoping to create something beautiful out of it, but the thing got off the table, and it ended up being this horrid-looking creature. So the people were reluctant to actually go and try to make peace in Turkmenistan, knowing that there was, at least outside information showed that there wasn't such peace as existed inside Turkmenistan, was forcibly imposed upon the people by the government.
Dr. Luca, was there any expectation from the international players that Turkmenistan becoming a neutral state and it is going to be a hub for a discussion, dialogues? Was there any expectations like that?
I hope they didn't have any, because they didn't eventuate at all. I just want to go back a second, Muhammad, to what Bruce was saying. He was super right in saying that when Niyazi spoke about neutrality first, because that was a very much an idea which was very much from the president. If you look at very early foreign policy of Turkmenistan in 92, I go back, when you have Abdi Kuliyev, the foreign minister, Kuliyev never once mentioned neutrality. Then as soon as he resigned in the summer of 92, that became a policy that was portrayed everywhere. So it became very much of Niyazi's, if you want, baby, in the sense that it was something that the president himself wanted to achieve, and he engaged Shikhmuradov to carry it on. So in that sense, he was very much closely linked with the presidential administration. So in that sense, the evolution of neutrality could not really be separated, divorced from the evolution of Turkmenistan authoritarianism, which is not a pretty one. So in that sense, as the regime became more and more extreme, neutrality became less and less of a policy of engagement to peace, and became more and more of a policy made to satisfy the internal domestic considerations of the regime. So this is the context with which the international community had to deal with. So if they have an expectation that Turkmenistan could become a place of engagement, it was the outlook of the regime itself which became more and more withdrawn, if you want. That made neutrality less and less positive. They always use positive in the sense of active, of something that makes something out of it, not just a policy of withdrawal, at least on paper. So in that sense, I hope that the reception for sure in the West wasn't very positive, but also in the former Soviet Union, people look at neutrality by looking at a very idiosyncratic regimes, that the policy that is carried out virtually exclusively for Niyazov purpose, which also explains why it's so important domestically for propaganda. And we saw, especially at the CIS level, when Turkmenistan finally downgraded its membership, that policy was not really a policy of engagement, but became a policy of either isolation or insulation.
Right. The question I just came to my mind is maybe belongs to our second phase of the discussion, but I could not resist to ask that. Then why all this noise about neutrality by the Turkmen authorities, like 472 mass events organized over the past 11 months? What they really achieve by that? Who answers this question?
I think you have a quick answer, and I think it's about legitimacy. They think that as neutrality is popular, unique development, especially because it was recognized by the UN. We're celebrating the UN approval of the resolution A58 for the anniversary, that people in the regime want the Turkmen population to see that whatever has been done by the regime has been recognized as highly as the UN. So it's that kind of legitimacy they want to get.
Is that your thinking, Ruslan?
Yeah, it's legitimacy and building the image. Yeah, because the official Turkmen media always point and highlight that the government of Turkmenistan, the country's president, are being recognized in the world, that the legitimacy and the authority of the regime is growing in the world. I don't know what they mean by that, but of course this is food for internal consumption. Because outside of Turkmenistan, of course, I live in Europe and I speak with people. When I tell them that I'm from Turkmenistan, some of them don't even know where it is.
Right. Okay, let's take a short break here. When we come back, we will look into how the neutrality policy of Turkmenistan evolved over the time and what it did become and how useful it is for Turkmenistan under current regional and global realities. Welcome back to the Majlis. Today we are discussing Turkmenistan's neutrality and how relevant is this policy under current reality. Joining me in the studio is Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlag Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. From Glasgow, I have Dr. Lukan Çiftçi, who is director of Glasgow's University's Central Asia Studies Center and author of book on Turkmenistan's neutrality. I'm also joined by phone by Ruslan Matiev, who is head of Alternative News Turkmenistan, a web portal based in Europe. I am Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. In the first half of the show, Dr. Luka, you briefed us about the term of neutrality. Looking back over the past 20 years of Turkmenistan's neutral policy, how it has evolved, what did it become from its original idea?
Yes, the first evolution is what Bruce has detailed before.
Right.
The fact that it was supposed to be a policy of triangular engagement, and then eventually, especially after 2003, became a policy of withdrawal. Then I think that in the Mehdi Muhammadov era, you know, after the tremendous, the terrible end of the Niyazov time, the last 3 years were super, super authoritarian in that sense. So when Mehdi Muhammadov took charge, neutrality became more of a policy of disengagement. You know, as you played the clip before in which he said, we're not going to be part of military alliance, and we can't do that, and so on. So it became a policy of allowing Turkmenistan to stay at the margins of the political landscape, if you want, of that part of Eurasia. Of course, neutrality doesn't really touch upon gas, which I always find a very, very strong contradiction, because gas, on the other hand, as we saw, and you guys have done a fantastic job in describing that, requires engagement on the other end. So I think that in the Mehdi Muhammadov era, the policy didn't really change, but became much more of a policy of progressive disengagement with what is on. We was the CIS before, and now the Eurasian Economic Union. I mean, Turkmenistan never mentioned any interest, but they always said, you know, we can't get in because we are part of the neutrality world. So I think that if the policy, however, has got different sort of manifestation, I think what really always stay at the core of the policy was the fact that it had to allow Niyazov first and Berdimuhamedov then to stay in power. So it's a very much of a domestic center foreign policy, if I may say so.
Yeah, Bruce, you're raising your hand. The what was the reason for this change of policy or drawing back from what originally the neutral policies dictates, Bruce? Why Turkmenistan just decided to step back from the original idea?
I'll address that, but I wanted to just throw in one point, because there is one success to this neutrality policy, but you have to go back to the Afghanistan at the time of the Taliban, and Luca and I have already spoken about this, so this won't be anything new for him, but it is true to say that at the time when the Taliban were coming to power in Afghanistan, Turkmenistan actually was the only of all the six, so-called 6+2 group that they had at the time, was the only honest broker in that whole thing, because they really didn't have an interest in Afghanistan. And that was, I think this led the Turkmen government of the time under Niyazov to see that this was potentially a success, because while Uzbekistan and Tajikistan were drawn into Afghanistan, or certainly had very, very bad ties with the Taliban in the late 1990s, Turkmenistan was able to keep out of that entirely and still negotiate with both sides in Afghanistan and maintain fairly friendly relations with them. Now, I think, you know, Luca rightly pointed to the date of, to the year 2003. I think by 2003, it had occurred to the Turkmen authorities that the original purpose of this policy of neutrality was impossible to fulfill. They weren't getting any interest from outside foreign actors at all. The cult of personality was already being well developed at that point. And Turkmenistan had been criticized, rightly, on a number of points by outside organizations for rights abuses, failure to implement democratic reforms, things like that. So it ended up being neutrality became a cocoon instead that Turkmenistan wrapped itself around in and said that, you know, this UN-recognized policy is our shield. It's what keeps the evils of the outside world from getting into Turkmenistan. Actually, that's still pretty much their line. The world has an economic crisis, but that's not Turkmenistan's fault. And there might be security problems in Afghanistan right now, but that's not Turkmenistan's fault. Such information as the public does hear about these kind of events is couched exactly in those terms. They don't hear very much about global economic crisis or about problems in Afghanistan, but the very little bit of information they get is always followed immediately by the fact that we're safe because we have this policy. And then that's supposed to justify the fact that Turkmen can't go abroad. It's very hard for them, that other people can't get into the country very easily, because they're neutrality. They don't want the evil outside ideas coming into their country. So this policy of neutrality is somehow sheltering them. They don't get dragged into these military alliances, you know, where all of a sudden they're forced to send peacekeepers or play a more active role, things like that. So that's the ultimate guarantee of security and good living for all the people of Turkmenistan is the fact that they're aloof from all these problems because of this policy.
Okay, you know, now things are developing the way it is developing in the other side of the Turkmen border in Afghanistan. It's something that it is a challenge, obviously. Turkmenistan is not in a position to say that we are not attacked because we are neutral, because in fact the attack took place at least twice, and the danger is there, real. Can Turkmenistan sustain this policy of neutrality in this situation, Dr. Luca?
Well, it can, because they use neutrality in such a flexible way that it means everything at its opposite at the same time. I mean, one thing which you want to argue about the trouble at the border is that, you know, we've been saying for months that, you know, like, that would challenge the notion that Turkmenistan cannot be invaded because it's neutral. But I don't think that kind of news travels so fast into Ashgabat. Obviously, it's not on the media, so it's always just only by word of mouth. So I don't think that maybe in the immediate region, yes, there has been some sort of erosion of this narrative. But if you go into the capital, I think that people still are mostly unaware of what's going on at the border. And of course it can sustain, because the government can use this policy in whatever way they want it, because it's so poorly framed and so vague. I mean, I read all the documents. So, I mean, at least those of the Niyazov era, I mean. And it's so vague and so general, which obviously is a deliberate choice, because it allows them flexibility to use the policy as engagement of disengagement. What I don't see, though, and this goes beyond neutrality, because it touches upon the central sort of interest of regime survival, is that they will ask for support for external sort of Russia, the US or China, whatever it is, to fix the Afghan border situation.
Yeah.
I don't think that will happen, because the regime does not want to become too dependent on anyone. But how would they frame that? They will use neutrality. They would say, we could have asked for that, but we won't, because we are neutral. So again, this become a policy that they can use to justify, and they've done it, by the way. They justify engagement, disengagement, isolation, insulation, everything with the same policy umbrella for 20 years now.
Right, but again, we don't know how things are going to develop in the Afghan side of the border, but it is tense, and it remains tense, and if you look into the flocking of the militants to northern Afghanistan, it is dangerous. Okay, one hand, the Turkmenistan might defy its position, stating that it is neutral against external pressures, like the pressure that Russia is putting on Turkmenistan to do something on the border. On the other hand, Turkmenistan's own need to protect the border might lead to ask for help from other countries like Russia, or maybe Uzbekistan, maybe Turkey, for example. Can this kind of situation be accommodated in the neutral policy? Who's going to answer that?
Yeah. Theoretically, it could, because they will frame it in a way in which they say, well, we ask for help to X, Y, or Z, but we're not going to enter a military alliance with them. There's a perfectly neutral, if you want, solution to the conflict. I still believe it's not going to happen, though, Mohammed, because domestic considerations, power technologies, survival of the regime as it is actually probably all it matters to the elite that we've seen at the moment ruling Ashgabat. So I would be very skeptical. I mean, I can't see that happening at all, asking for some more help, especially at the time in which the elite has already got a very strongly economic dependency on China. So you would put another dependency, in this case a military one, with a lot of foreign power. This is not how they've been working for 25 years. And if you look at the very narrow objective of stay in power, they've been successful. You can't say they aren't. So I would be very skeptical to see. I mean, I would be very interested to hear what Bruce has got to say about this.
The first thing I'd point out, and me and Muhammad were just talking about this before the show too, was, for what it's worth, when the militants ended up on that island between Turkmenistan and Afghanistan, the militant that they captured made a point of saying that these armed people went up to where the border was on the island, and the Turkmen border guards, one of the first things out of their mouth was, we're a neutral country and we're not getting involved in your dispute. And this was just a little more than a month ago, and that seemed to work. This time, anyway, that did seem to work. Now, in a country like Turkmenistan, where the government has total control over information that the public is receiving, one could imagine that if they did need outside military help and they called on, say, neighboring Uzbekistan or something to send some troops and clean up the border situation, that could be spun, if word got out at all, that could be spun as knowing that Turkmenistan was a neutral country, our fraternal neighbor Uzbekistan decided to come and get this riffraff, these stateless people, away from our border to preserve the purity of neutrality in Turkmenistan without us selling our own hands. You know, so if word got out, like I said, we know that they're masters of controlling information, and people inside Turkmenistan, as Luca pointed out, don't really know that there is a problem on the Turkmen border. I'm going to be very curious to see how they do with Caspian politics. Like I said, they're getting to the point where they're going to have to try to do something. Erdogan's visit that's coming up is probably linked to the construction of the Trans-Caspian pipeline. Now, we're a neutral country, and we don't want to participate in the politics of the Caspian Sea. It's not going to work with Russia and Iran. And they're going to have to, Turkmenistan is going to have to take some kind of position which will take them away from neutrality. It would be more interesting to see how they explain that, how they can insist upon their right to cooperate with Azerbaijan, and that's part of being neutral while at the same time rejecting the Russian and Iranian opinions on what should be done in the Caspian Sea.
So taking a position on Caspian Sea, is it going to be something against the neutrality? Is it the way we should understand that?
Well, they're going to have to take a stand, that's for sure. And it's not, you know, it's going to, their stand that they take is going to put them in conflict with somebody. So it's not pure neutrality where they can keep out of this anymore.
Interesting. We were talking about the Afghan-Turkmen border. That's my favorite subject. Ruslan, you were reporting about some huge mobility of military in that border, and we were talking about the possibility of Turkmenistan might wish to have some external support or not. So what is happening there? Is there something that is, which you consider could potentially be raising question about the neutrality thing in terms of military?
Well, it's hard to really monitor what's going on the border between Afghanistan and Turkmenistan because, again, as rightly was mentioned, the government controls all of the information. But yes, indeed, pieces and bits of information do come out. And according to my sources, that up to 70% of the hard ammunition and military hardware is being sent to the border, precisely to the Turkmen-Afghan border. And going back to the question of sustainability of neutrality, I think it all depends on the intensity of events that are developing on the border. And my feeling is that in order to guarantee the survival of this regime, the Berdimuhamedov's government would do anything with the new status of neutrality, even adjusting it slightly maybe, or in any way it will find a way to, you know, inform its people that it's necessary. And of course the people in their majority would also understand it because it's their security, it's their safety.
Right. With this, we could, in fact, conclude our discussion. It is 35 minutes already. Is there any final word anyone want to add into this discussion, Dr. Luca, Bruce?
Look, I'd be very interested to know whether in 20 years' time we were still talking about neutrality, which, you know, it's what probably the regime, you know, thinks of. My bet is that unless you have a drastic regime change, this policy is going to percolate down any kind of leader in the sort of fairly fluid way in which he did after, you know, like with Berdimuhamedov. You know, the thing is that even rhetorically, in the Azov era, of course, the president was the thinker behind the policy. In Berdimuhamedov, you got this distinction between the architect of neutrality, which is Niyazov, and the protector, the defender of neutrality, which is Berdimuhamedov. So it's obviously something that the leaders look very carefully, and they think it's a powerful symbol, which, by the way, it is. At least that's what I hear. So I would be surprised if this is not the only policy of the Niyazov era that goes down in the post-Berdimuhamedov era when that happens.
This is, in fact, one of those policies, Dr. Luca, Berdimuhamedov enjoys celebrating.
Yeah.
As I just mentioned in terms of number of mass events that took place over the past 11 months. Thank you very much, Dr. Luca Ancescu, Director of Glasgow University's Central Asia Studies Center. Also, big thanks goes to Ruslan Matiev, head of the Alternative News Turkmenistan, and Bruce Panier, editor of RFERL's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Owazi. This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thank you very much for participating in the discussion, colleagues.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.